Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Hey there, AcRackers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to be back for another Master Clinician episode. I have with me a true Master Clinician in general, and specifically with OB anesthesiology, Dr. Bridget Mariquin. Now, you may recognize Bridget from having been on the show previously, but now she's back to represent herself as a Master Clinician. So she is an OB anesthesiologist and an associate professor at UNC. She's also one of the APDs of the residency program there. And really interestingly, Dr. Mariquin did an OB residency first, and then practiced obstetrics and gynecology for 4 years before then going back and doing an anesthesiology residency. And I want to read to you some of the comments that both faculty and residents who have worked with her submitted when nominating her to be a master clinician on the episode here. So here we go. Dr. Mariquin is one of the most impactful educators and clinicians we've had the privilege to work with, and we believe her insight and experience would resonate with your audience. She brings a unique and valuable perspective to obstetric anesthesiology as she completed a full OBGYN residency and practiced as an obstetrician prior to her anesthesiology training. Her clinical acumen reflects the depth of both specialties, and she consistently models a thoughtful, collaborative style that elevates patient care. Another one, more than her clinical expertise, however, Dr. Mariquin's leadership and teaching truly set her apart. She is a gifted communicator and an emotionally intelligent leader, so much so that she led a didactic series on emotional intelligence in medicine and leadership for our residency program. She fosters a team culture where everyone feels seen, supported, and empowered, from chief residents to medical students. Her influence has been foundational for many of us in training, myself included, and she remains a role model for the kind of clinician I hope to become. And finally, Dr. Mariquin is a phenomenal educator and communicator. She's the kind of leader that makes everyone feel valuable to the team. She handles conflict with assertive curiosity and navigates tough interdisciplinary situations with poise. She has served as a role model for me and many of my co-residents. I think your listeners would love to hear her perspective. I couldn't agree more, and I am thrilled to have her on the show. Bridget, welcome back to ACRAC.
Thank you so much. Those words are very kind and humbling, and I do believe, no doubt, my prior experience as an obstetrician definitely makes navigating this space a little easier. And I think it helps the residents and my colleagues navigate it as well, I hope. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, clearly it does. And, you know, I love that because I think it's such a good reminder too for folks out there who maybe, you know, I started a different residency and then switched in anesthesia. You did an entire one. You know, for folks who are thinking maybe they're not happy in their current residency, but they're thinking it just seems like too daunting to switch, you know, people like you who not only switched after an entire residency and beginning practice, but who are glad they did. I mean, glad they did. They wouldn't go back and change it, right? That experience right. has added to your career. And clearly, as we saw in these comments, has been part of what has made you such an incredible teacher and mentor to the people who've had the privilege of working with you. So I think that's really wonderful to see and to hear.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, you and I were just talking before you hit the record button about interview season, and certainly the fourth year medical students are nervous and they're starting their interview season. I mean, there have been fourth year medical students I talked to in January, and they're halfway through the interview process and they say, "Oh my goodness, Dr. Mariquin, I just did 4 weeks of anesthesia and I love it. And I, you know, I can't do peds or I don't want to do medicine." And then, you know, we help them navigate it. You're never too old. It's never too late. And yes, there were many times in the 3 years of the anesthesia residency, you know, two kids at home and a husband who was a surgeon, and I'd be in the hospital doing ICU and I'd call him in tears. "I can't do this. I'm exhausted. These patients are too sick." So I wouldn't go back and redo it, but in retrospect, I'm so glad that I did. Right. My husband said to me when I was sort of deciding if I wanted to go back or not, and he said, "Honey, the blood, sweat, and tears we put into what we do every day." And I share this with students and residents as well. We put so much energy into what we do. You want to be happy. You have to get up and go to work every day, and you want to enjoy it, right? So I feel like you and I and many of the people we work with thankfully have found our space, what fills our cup.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about some of the pearls that you have gained over the years that you teach your trainees. And so obviously these are going to center around your experience in OB anesthesia. That's your specialty. Talk about what it means to be a pessimist, and why that it might be a good thing.
So I have to give a little background, right? So in the OB world, training and residents, we would say, this is going to sound terrible, we would say all patients are liars. Okay. So that doesn't sound very good, but patients are forgetful, right? So somebody shows up in the emergency room, she's got abdominal pain, and you ask her if she's sexually active, she says no. You just assume she forgot. Everybody gets a pregnancy test. And then, so all patients are sexually active, all patients are pregnant, all pregnancies are ectopic until proven otherwise, right? You sort of check off the boxes that are concerning. So when I have a patient who's on labor and delivery, she's got a labor epidural, I tell the resident, okay, every patient might need our care. So if you're at team sign out, if the OBs are telling you about somebody, even if the patient, she wants to be completely natural, she doesn't want an epidural, pay attention. She might need us. Everybody who has an epidural, that epidural might go to the OR. You might have to use it for cesarean delivery. You might have to use it for a, you know, postpartum hemorrhage DNC. So every epidural might go to the OR. Don't be afraid to replace them. You know, tee them up, dose them up, try to, you know, check a level. If patient's not happy, you're not happy, just replace it sooner rather than later. Yeah. Early replacement is easy. So that's sort of my pessimist.
Yeah. You know, I love that, because we think of pessimism as a bad thing, but you know, the way you're framing it, and I agree, I think it applies to so many things. It's can be so important. And I tell people that I think it's important to be what I call a red light person. And what I mean is, if you are planning, let's say, okay, I'm on call tonight. All right, I've got to be there to get signed out at 7 p.m. So if I say to myself, well, listen, if I leave my house and all the lights are green on my way to work, it's going to take me 15 minutes. So I'll leave at 6:45 because, you know, I'll be there at 7 if all the lights are green. That's a green light person. If you're a red light person, you say, well, I'm going to assume all the lights are going to be red, in which case it will take me 25 minutes. So I will leave at 6:30 in case one of those lights is broken and never turns green, right? So I'm going to really plan as a pessimist. And then you will never be late for sign out, and you will always be at least on time and often early, and your colleague will feel like you care about them and respect them, right? So that kind of pessimism, I think, is really important when we're working in our specialty.
Yeah. And I think, another way to phrase it is plan for the worst, hope for the best, right?
Yep.
If I think, you know, maybe I should get blood in the room, if it crosses my mind, we're just getting blood in the room, right? Like maybe she's at high risk, you know, laboring for 4 days, pushing for 3 hours, now infected. Let's just get some blood in the room. She's going to hemorrhage potentially.
Totally.
Right.
Let's talk about the specifics of replacing an epidural. So let's say you have a patient, she's got an epidural in, you place the epidural, maybe you do a CSE, that's very common these days, and she's got initial great control, and then the kind of spinal part wears off, and now she's got one-sided pain relief. Do you immediately replace it? Do you try to troubleshoot? You know, what's your approach there?
Oh, so glad you asked. So I tend to So check your levels, right? So now you recognize that it's one-sided. And I, in my opinion, the definition of one-sided is more than two dermatomes off. So if it's T8, T10, not really one-sided, but, you know, T6, T10, potentially one-sided. So I always try volume first. I don't pull it back right away. So having been doing OB anesthesia long enough, having personally had some epidurals in labor, the textbooks would tell you that positioning doesn't matter for bolusing an epidural. We can put the patient on her head. If it's a lumbar epidural, it's going to fill the lumbar space, right? Thoracic epidural, it's going to fill the thoracic space. But the way our epidurals sort of drip, drip, drip slowly, certainly if you're running 10 mLs an hour over a continuous infusion, potentially if the patient falls asleep on her right side, she might have more of a right-sided block, right? So I tell the residents, just try volume first. And then if you come back and check it again, it's still one-sided, the same side is higher, then pull it back a half centimeter to a centimeter and then volume. But I feel as though, especially if you've done a CSE and you've confirmed your midline, I feel as though very often they're one-sided and then later on they're bilateral and maybe they're one-sided the other side. And I think documentation is really important too, from one shift to the next. Oh, she was T6, T10. The right side was higher. In 4 hours, she's T7, T10, but now it's the left side. Oh, of course the epidural must be in the midline.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. And let's say you try volume, you bolus it. It's still one-sided. At that point, maybe you pull it back and try still at that point, one-sided. At some point, you're going to say, we just need to replace this.
Right. Yeah, I think after a couple of pullbacks, and certainly if you pull back so much that you don't have more than 3 centimeters in the space, it's time. It's time to replace. Yeah,
and,
for sure.
And you just go up or down a level and do it, or how do you replace it?
And I have to say, not necessarily a specific up or down. I think whatever space feels good.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe the upper space is wider, the lower space is wider. Yeah.
And how about the classic conundrum of you have an epidural, it's working, okay for labor. You have to now go to C-section. You bolus it and you do not have adequate analgesia for a C-section. Now what?
Great question. So I will, in my mind, commit to using the epidural initially. If there's any question, if I think, once again, it's that plan for the worst, hope for the best. So if there's any question, I just pull it out and do a CSE in the back, in the OR. But if I'm thinking, okay, it looks like good levels, I'll commit to it. If after 8 mLs, like I'll do a 3 mL test dose and then 5 mLs, if after 8 mLs, maybe 10, you could push me to 10, I'm not seeing any rise, then we pause, we sit up, we do a CSE. If in my mind, okay, I got to 10, I'm giving more, I've already committed to, I'm putting her to sleep if this doesn't work, right? So once I've committed to filling up that epidural space, I've already told myself, it's either working, I have faith in this epidural, and if that doesn't work out, then we're going to go off general anesthesia. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we just did an episode on this with some of your colleagues in OB anesthesia. Obviously, much listened to podcast from, now I'm blanking on the name, but about the pain after C-section, pain during C-section.
Retrievals.
The Retrievals, yes. Season 2 of The Retrievals, covered this. So, you know, do you think we have swung kind of as a specialty too far towards the avoid general at all costs, and we should be more willing to go to sleep if a patient is experiencing pain during C-section?
Hard to say, I think, because I, except for, you know, a patient with a terrible airway or some crazy cardiac something, and I, for that reason, I don't want to put them to sleep. I feel as though I've always been we're going to go to sleep. And I try to be sort of black and white about it, but it's, you know, it's not every clinical case is easy to decide. Right. And, I do have a story about a, high spinal though, thinking about replacing epidurals and going back.
Yeah.
So, I came in and probably a Monday morning, Tuesday morning on labor and delivery. And this woman had been induction of labor, maybe for a day and a half, 2 days. She had an epidural. And her epidural was working, but she was complaining a lot of scapular pain. And now in retrospect, now no doubt her epidural space was full of volume. But she was complaining about the same time the OB said, well, she's been pushing for 3 hours. We're now going to go back to the OR. So she's sort of complaining, but then she's also, you know, emotionally upset about now, you know, after 2 days, I'm going to the OR and probably some intra-amniotic infection going on. So it's a little bit of a rush. And I went and checked a level and she had, you know, pretty good levels, maybe T10, T10 to sharp. And, I take that back. She didn't have good levels, right? But she's complaining of like just her neck hurts and her back hurts and she's been in this labor bed. Okay. So we decide, okay, we're not going to dose the epidural at all. I didn't dose at all. Take you back. We'll do a CSE. She's probably 5'4", BMI of, you know, 38, sort of, you know, not too big, not too short, not too tall. Pulled out the epidural, did a CSE, gave her standard 1.6 heavy bupivacaine, taped up the epidural, laid her down probably within a minute of the epidural. And she immediately could not phonate, but mouthed to me, I cannot breathe.
Wow.
That was my first and only ever high spinal. And no doubt was because her fecal epidural space was full of volume, you know, how many, you know, 100, 150 ml. And then the spinal I gave her just went really high. And so I said to the OBs, she has a high spinal. And they said, is she stable? And I turned the monitor towards them and I said, her blood pressure's good. I grabbed the mask from the machine and I, you know, essentially did CPAP to the patient. And I talked with her the whole time. And I said, you have a really high spinal. I'm going to help you breathe. This will probably last, you know, a few minutes. I said, I can put you to sleep if you're really feeling very anxious. And I understand it's safe either way. I can put you to sleep. Do you want me to put you to sleep completely? And she shook her head no. And I said, okay, I'll keep checking with you. And I said, your husband can come back once you can breathe, you know, on your own without the support from the mask. So from the time we laid her down to the time she could breathe on her own was about 8-9 minutes. In retrospect, I wish I told the OBs to go faster to deliver the baby. So she was hemodynamically stable, but the baby came out really acidotic. And so I think what happened was she was ventilating, but probably not effectively even with, you know, sort of CPAP support from us. So I think if I had a high spinal in the future, I would say her blood pressure is good, but hurry up because she's probably going to be hypercarbic.
Interesting.
That's my theory. And as I said, it's the only high spinal I've had since then. And I've talked to a number of people and most OB anesthesiologists said, yes, you did the right thing. You don't have to intubate them if they're stable and, you know, talk to her. And then some people who don't do a lot of OB say, oh my gosh, the one I had in my career, I put him to sleep. So I think either choice is the right choice. And the crazy thing is, you know, talking with the patient and the husband afterwards and the OBs and telling him everything that went on and, you know, very apologetic and, you know, just sort of explained the physiology. She came back 3 years later for her scheduled cesarean delivery for baby number two. And I just happened to be on and I walked into the room and reintroduced myself and she remembered me, her husband remembered me. And I said, I'm sure you have trauma from your first delivery. And if you want another anesthesiologist, we can get you one today. And she said, no, we want you to take care of us. So that was sort of full circle. That was, I learned a lot that day. And then even in retrospect, you know, we reviewed the M&M about the newborn pH and such, but yeah, high spinals, there's not a right answer.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And what I love about that, and I bet if I had to guess, the reason she was so clear that she wanted you to take care of her again is because you involved her in the decision, right? You didn't just say, we're going to sleep or we're not going to sleep. You said, listen, both are fine. It's up to you, right? And that's one of the things we heard a lot in the Retrievals podcast and that, you know, I think people hear from when they talk to patients about this is that if you make them feel like going to sleep is a mistake, then that's then they feel like they don't have a choice. And if you just put them to sleep, then they definitely didn't have a choice. And so if you can, offering them a choice and letting them be part of that discussion, I think that probably made her feel really supported by you. Let's talk about NPO status. What have you learned over the years? What do you teach about that?
So this is a tough one to teach and even sometimes wrap my head around. And certainly the OBs, I feel really badly for them because they, from their perspective, it's like, oh, whatever anesthesiologist you get on board, that's the rules today for NPO status. So, you know, there's the scheduled, I'm coming in for my scheduled repeat cesarean delivery, or I'm coming in for my scheduled breech, you know, breech positioning cesarean delivery. And those patients absolutely should be appropriately NPO. And then here's a story. So a woman repeat cesarean delivery scheduled for tomorrow or something. And she comes in tonight at midnight, ruptured membranes, breech. And she comes in at midnight, you know, ruptured membrane, she's laboring a little bit. But she had a bowl of cereal at 10 p.m., cereal with milk. And so the anesthesia team said, well, NPO will be 6 a.m., which is true. NPO 8 hours will be 6 p.m. or 6 a.m. after the 10 p.m. cereal. And, you know, the story goes on, and then she's contracting, and then she's really uncomfortable. And then they put in an epidural, and then finally they went back, and then, you know, they couldn't use the epidural. It's just a crazy, crazy story. And so in reviewing it with the residents and, you know, the attending, and we reviewed it in our M&M, once, like, she comes in labor, it's not elective anymore, right? She's not scheduled. And even if you waited 8 hours, I mean, she's in so much pain that she's requesting a labor epidural. She won't have an empty stomach at 6 a.m. So better to just have the OBs write in their note, you know, this is an unscheduled, not elective cesarean delivery. She's laboring, she's breached. She could drop a cord, you know, if she dilated her cervix enough. So that's what I try to keep the resident. Like, okay, let's just put the scheduled ones in one box, and then the unscheduled ones in the other box. It doesn't mean you have to go back at midnight when she hits the door, give her some metoclopramide, give her some famotidine, give her her Bisitra. Sure. But that's important, is, you know, talk with your OBs. How soon ideally should we go back, and just put the scheduled in one box and the unscheduled in all that goes in the other box. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's I think that's one of those things that you gain with time and experience, is that not, you can't just put people in boxes. So it can't just be like elective, not elective, right? You have to look at the individual patient, the individual situation, and be willing to be flexible.
Correct. Right. And that's what it is, right? It's my now years of experience that I can share that. Yeah.
And I would imagine that, you know, a lot of this is going to come down to good communication with the OB team and then documentation, right? So if what you're afraid of is, well, if we try this and she aspirates, and I have no ground to stand on legally, but if you document and they document that this is not elective, that this is urgent, that this needs to happen, then that's okay, right? Then I think anyone would agree that's okay.
Correct, right. Communication and documentation. And sometimes there's communication and everyone's speaking the same primary language, but the OBs are saying, what's your, you know, NPO number? And they're saying, well, it's 8 hours. Well, we can't wait till 6 a.m., but yet she had cereal. But no, really, what are you concerned about anesthesia? I'm concerned about aspiration. What are you concerned about with the OB? I'm concerned that, you know, she's going to potentially rupture her uterus, potentially, right, prior C-section, or drop a cord. And she won't empty her stomach after 8 hours of labor.
Right. Okay, great. Let's talk about 2-chlorprocaine. I think you're a fan of that. How do you use it? What do you recommend people do with it?
I am a fan. I'm a fan 2-chlorprocaine for the urgent fetal bradycardia. We're running down the hallway. We don't have monitors on as we're running down the hallway. I will give 20 mLs of chlorprocaine somewhere between the labor room and the OR, like 5 mls in the room, 5 in the hallway, another 5 in the hallway, and then get to the OR, check a blood pressure quick. If it's good, give the other 5. So 20 mls of 3% two-chloroprocaine, probably in about 5 minutes time. And certainly, you know, you could ask, are you, you know, any ringing in your ears, any taste in your mouth? She could have transient symptoms from intravascular injection if the epidural for some reason intravascular, but she won't seize, right? She won't seize. And so my thought is if you push 3% two-chloroprocaine, you get back to the OR, you check a level, you still have fetal bradycardia, you've lost nothing. If she doesn't have a block, she's going to go to sleep.
And so the reason when you say she won't seize, is that because 2-chloroprocaine is much less toxic than lidocaine?
It's because it's an ester. So it'll get metastasized. So if by rare chance that catheter is intravascular, her pseudocholinesterase will metabolize that ester. And so she might get funny symptoms, but she won't seize. You won't put her into cardiac arrest like you would with bupivacaine.
Right.
Yeah. But lidocaine, if for some reason that catheter that's been working well, for some reason, maybe some of the end holes are in a vessel and you didn't know it, or when you're pushing really fast, you pop open some vessel you hit during placement, you could make her seize with lidocaine.
Interesting.
She won't have cardiac arrest, but she could seize, and nobody likes a seizing pregnant patient.
Definitely. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. Whether you're caring for patients in the OR or managing unstable airways in the ICU, you know it's the unexpected high-stakes airways that stay with you. The ones where decision-making, technique, and team communication make all the difference. And if you want to be prepared for these situations, I highly recommend you check out the Difficult Airway Course, a hands-on airway course designed for clinicians managing high-risk airways. The Difficult Airway Course offers accredited hands-on training with specialty-specific courses designed for anesthesia, critical care, and emergency medicine. The focus is on practical, immediately applicable skills, including airway assessment and planning, video laryngoscopy, fiber optic techniques, peri-intubation optimization, and managing failed or rapidly evolving airways. What sets the course apart is the format: small group hands-on workshops and realistic code airway scenarios led by a world-class faculty. Courses are offered 4 times this year, in March and November in San Diego, May in Boston, and September in Atlanta. Space is limited, so groups stay small, with plenty of opportunity for questions and conversations with faculty. So if you're looking to sharpen your airway skills, whether you're early in your practice or many years in, visit theairwaysite.com to find your course and register. As a bonus, our listeners can use code ACRAC26 to save $100 on registration. That's theairwaysite.com and use code ACRAC26.
Hey, ACRACers, we are thrilled to have as a returning sponsor the one and only TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. I love that it's customizable, so you can target weak areas or take a longer or shorter practice exam anytime. Their metrics are great, and their mobile app lets you study on the go. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. And now they have a fabulous flashcard product, which you can check out, and I highly recommend it. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAC to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACCRAC.
Hey folks, the mornings are getting colder, holidays are coming up. That's when you need a one-stop shop for stuff that looks sharp, feels good, and that is just as tempting to keep for yourself as it is to gift. That's why I go with Quince. Quince has great options like Mongolian cashmere sweaters, and at Quince you can pick one up for $50 when you'd normally drop $200 or more on the same thing. Plus wool coats that actually hold up to daily wear and still look good. They do it by partnering directly with trusted factories that maintain high standards for craftsmanship and ethical practices, cutting out the middlemen and markups. That means premium quality at half the cost of other high-end brands.
The zip-up fleece I just got is perfect for these chillier days. It looks good, keeps me warm, and was totally reasonably priced. Even my wife thinks it looks good on me, and that is saying a lot. And Quince has more than just clothing. Have you picked up anything for home, bath, kitchen, or travel to share or keep this holiday? If not, check out the amazing deals from Quince. Get your wardrobe sorted and your gift list handled with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ACRAC. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey, folks, you know what can make a real difference in your quality of life at work? Comfortable scrubs. And not just any scrubs, but Fig scrubs. They're made for awesome humans and I think can truly make a difference for healthcare workers. These are scrubs that have our needs in mind. They're durable, antimicrobial, and super comfortable, which matters when you're 10 hours into your shift. I love my Figs, and let me tell you, my wife, a pediatrician, loves hers too. She wears them to work every day, as do many of the doctors and nurses I work with. It doesn't matter if you're a dentist, a nurse practitioner, an anesthesiologist like me, or even a medical student starting out. Investing in a couple of pairs of Figs is totally worth it. With the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because Figs just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. If you want to check them out, Figs is offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com with the code FIGSRX. Check them out today and make your life at work a little better in the new year. Hey there, ACRACers. Fall is my favorite season, and it always feels like a reset between back to school, busier routines, and shorter days. Finding time to cook can be tough. That's why I love Factor. Their chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals make it easy to stay on track and enjoy something comforting and delicious, no matter how hectic the season gets. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and it really does. Even my two younger daughters, who are very picky eaters, are loving every meal we get from Factor. Some favorites are the chicken burrito bowl and premium proteins like salmon and shrimp that come at no extra cost. And with 65 different meal options, you've got savory global flavors like the new Asian-inspired meals influenced by China, Thailand, and more. It's not surprising that 97% of customers say Factor helped them live a healthier life. And the amazing thing is that it's not just healthy, but super fast and so delicious. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Get started at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first box plus free breakfast for a year. That's code ACRAC50OFF at factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off plus free breakfast for an entire year. All right, and we're back.
This is why you're the expert. So, yeah, I mean, I knew 2-chloroprocaine was fast, but I did not realize that you could kind of be safer from a side effect standpoint if you have to give it fast and you're worried about that. So that's a really interesting point.
And for our for the residents who are listening, who may have to take their boards at some point, onset has to do with PKA, right? The closer the PKA is to pH, you're more likely to traverse over the cell membrane. Lidocaine's PKA is actually closer to pH. I think lidocaine is high sevens. Chlorpromazine is high eights. So you would think lidocaine would work faster, but we're using 3% chlorpromazine, which is 30 milligrams per ml, as opposed to lidocaine, which is 20.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're giving more. Yeah. More milligrams.
More molecules.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember that from studying for my boards.
Right.
So that's for epidurals, for pushing it if you're going for a stat C-section. How about, do you ever use it in spinals?
I do. I like it for cerclages. Once again, the scheduled cerclage, 13, 14, 15 weeks, like, oh, we're coming in, should be pretty, the OBs, the MFM should be pretty quick, stitch, stitch, stitch. Chlorpromazine is great. I've had some nurses who, maybe almost routinely work with OB anesthesiologists who use bupivacaine, which also is great. But then if it's an outpatient, she's supposed to go home. She might not go home for 4, 5, 6 hours by the time her legs come back. Even if you give a small dose, 9 milligrams or 8 milligrams or something of the heavy bupivacaine. So talk with your surgeon. And if you say to the surgeon, I'll give you an anesthetic that will last, you've got 45 minutes. And usually they say, yeah, that's plenty of time. Now, if it's the cerclage that's 19, 20 weeks, maybe she's already dilated. She's got maybe hourglassing membranes. You have to put her in Trendelenburg. They might want to push the membranes back before they do the cerclage. She's probably not going home after the procedure. And I will definitely give the OBs bupivacaine longer acting.
Yeah.
I actually did a postpartum tubal recently with chlorprocaine. The anesthesia resident after the case said, oh my goodness, Dr. Merrickman, I've never done a chlorprocaine spinal for postpartum tubal. And I said, me either. That was my first one.
And it worked well.
We were in the main OR, and there's a family planning fellowship here at UNC. So the family planning fellow, who's a second year, who also sometimes covers labor and delivery on the weekends, I knew he was efficient, fast surgeon. So it was just a fellow in the attending. And I said, do you think you could do this tubal in a normal sized patient? She delivered, 18 hours prior. I said, can you do this in under an hour? And he said, absolutely. So we did 60 milligrams, which should give you about 90 minutes. And it worked really well. And then she got up and she went home later on that day. It was beautiful. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. And then how about, do you ever use it for non-OB cases?
I think it can be great in urology. Once again, cystostent or something, have a conversation with a surgeon. Once again, I think a lot of what we do is, like we talked in the beginning, communication. Maybe the surgeon will say, no, I've got to do some lithotripsy, or, oh, there's two stones, or it might be a little tortuous ureter. I need more than an hour. But sometimes it's, quick, just put up the stent and be done. And then I have not used it for ortho, but I have some friends in Vermont who there's some relatively efficient joint surgeons. So they use chlorprocaine for hips and knees, and then they're sending those patients home the same day.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
So an underutilized drug, but an interesting one. We've talked a lot about communication. Let's talk a little bit more about that in terms of kind of the terminology that we use. And I know you said that terminology can be confusing, misleading. We need to be really careful about how we communicate. Give me some examples of that.
So I just have to sort of, this sort of makes me think, I think a big reason why probably residents nominated me for this master clinician, or residents like working with me. I will admit I'm old, right? So there's a benefit to being old and graduating medical school more than 25 years ago. You've seen a lot, and you've worked with a lot of different surgeons, and maybe encountered some different crises or conflict, and I've been at four different academic institutions. So once again, you sort of learn what your colleagues do at this institution, what the surgeons do. And so I think all the places I've been, we all struggle with, well, what do we call the hurry up bad baby stat section? Do we call that stat? Do we call that emergent? What do we call the one that's, well, she's been laboring for, I don't know, half a day, and now she's got some late decelerations, but not terminal fetal bradycardia. That's not as urgent as the bradycardia, but still kind of urgent. And then you've got the one who's been laboring for 3 days and now she's infected and her baby looks, flat tracing and maybe some decels now and then. And then there's the, I came in and I'm stuck at 4 centimeters. Baby looks fine. I look fine. But, the patient's been here for 4 days. Or the one we already talked about, the one who comes in from home, ruptured membranes, scheduled section. So I think terminology is, there's probably some value in it. Keeping track of how quickly do you go back with a urgent, how quickly do you go back with a stat? Probably, I imagine more from maybe a nursing perspective, they probably have to keep track of some of those statistics and things. But really for me, I think it just comes down to communication. I mean, we have an overhead system here and it'll say, fetal bradycardia room 3, and we all run and we know what we're getting into, but we get in there and we say to the OBs, what do you have? What do you need? And sometimes it's better. Okay. Heart rate's back up. We don't need to do anything right now. So it comes down to tell me what the clinical scenario is and how urgent do we need to do that? And no doubt at your institution and many institutions across across the country. You know, these smaller rural hospitals that used to do OB are closing, the birthing centers are closing. So more and more deliveries are coming to these bigger hospitals, which is great. This is where the resources are. But I'm here at UNC where I trained. I finished 16 years ago. We have the same labor and delivery space, same labor rooms, three ORs that we had 16 years ago, and we're doing twice as many deliveries. So sometimes it's a matter of, I've got two things going on right now. I don't want to fill that third room unless I really have to. How urgent is this? And the OBs and the nurses certainly understand that too, right? Once you fill that up, then our next option is two buildings over, three floors down, main hospital. So my advice is don't get hung up on terminology,
right? Yeah. And be careful with it, as you said, right? I mean, like, it can be misunderstood. I have this very, very distinct memory from when I was a CA2 on OB, and we'd been told on our end, you know, if they call a stat C-section in the middle of the night, right? Like, we're going back and we are going to sleep, and we are, and if they have to splash and whatever, like, they're going to start. So we got to get to sleep as soon as we can. And sure enough, right, there's a stat C-section called, and I'm running from the call room, and I get in there, and my attending does not show up. And so I was in just pure panic mode. It's my first OB rotation. But in my head, I'm hearing, like, they said stat, and what I was told is this. So I tell the nurse, please call my attending one more time, and they do, and she still doesn't come. And so I just intubate, and thank God it went fine. But after the patient is intubated, you know, I look over, and the OB attending was like, well, no, I was just going to, like, watch for a little while. And I was like, that's not, like, you said it was a stat, right? So, like, knowing that is really important.
Yeah. And I think in Vermont, where I came from, the anesthesia attending at night still covers OB and OR. And that can be frustrating when you're covering the OR and you're running up from the second floor to the seventh floor, and you get to the room and nobody's actually in the operating room, but you said it was stat. And I think that's where attending to attending, I like to say adult to adult phone conversation, like the OB attending could call the anesthesia attending and say, we need you stat, or we've got some lates, we're moving as fast as we can, the nurses are opening up, we're counting, right? I mean, that's, you know, the people might say, well, why don't you just do everything in a hurry? Well, the nurses have to count, because if you don't have time to count instruments, then you've got to take the x-ray at the end. And, you know, that's a whole hassle too. So there are things we have to do before we take the patient back when we have time to be safe. But I also feel as though if we as anesthesiologists are not receptive to communication, to you know, leaving your pager number, or, you know, leaving your Vocera number, and they get, you know, reprimanded when they call you, then nobody wants to call you. So once again, we have to keep communication lines open. And, you know, when the residents call me in the middle of the night, or if I'm going to lay down and I'm on call, and I say, okay, call me anytime, but need me when you call me, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah. Like, I will come. Absolutely. That's my job, even if it's a silly question, but that's why I'm here.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk about setting up a safe space for learning. How do you do that? And what are some key things that you think people should be practicing and trying to learn these days?
So when the resident come back for their second month, I give them a little bit of the responsibility, because I feel as though we get so busy and we just say, okay, you know, spinal C-section. Okay, labor epidural, sit up, patient sitting up, labor epidural, patient sitting up. But I try to tell them, hey, so let's just do some things different your second month, but remind me and ask your other attendings, because I'm maybe in the whole month, I might be here four times, but ask your other attending, you know, if the patient looks totally normal size, low BMI, do a lateral epidural, right? I think, and they're like, but Dr. American, the nurses always set them up. I'm like, well, then get the nurse on your side. Like, hey, you know, if this patient wants an epidural later on, we could offer her lateral. I mean, some patients are more comfortable lateral in labor, and some patients are more comfortable sitting for the epidural and labor. But I think if we don't think about it, but sometimes you have to, for whatever reason, it's a terrible looking baby, or the patient says, oh, no. Like, I just can't sit up. There's too much pressure from that head. Or you've got to hurry up, hurry up C-section, we'll say, for ruptured membranes, and they're worried about a cord prolapse on somebody who's breech and 5 centimeters. So having the ability to do something lateral is key. So I think practicing it in the non-urgent scenario. Actually, when I was a resident, it has gone by the wayside, but we used plain bupivacaine, 0.5%, and we used heavy. And once again, I think the attendings just wanted us to get comfortable with both. So if it was a scheduled cesarean delivery and it was a normal size patient, we did it lateral. She'd be right side down. We'd do the heavy bupivacaine. And then that's when we used to do left uterine tilt. And then so the spina would float to the left when we tilted her. And then if we said, no, like the BMI is 40, we can't do lateral. And they would say, okay, we'll set them up. And we use 0.5%, 0.5% plain bupivacaine. And the idea was that it would just spread up and spread down. So I think having that ability to do lateral when you need to is key. So practicing it in the non-urgent setting is important. The same sort of thing, neuraxial ultrasound. I tell them, let's just ultrasound all our scheduled cesarean deliveries. It takes 2 minutes. You absolutely will palpate afterwards while you're doing the procedure, but get used to seeing what normal looks like, because when you have a BMI of 50 or 60, you really have to use your imagination and say, I think that's the ligamentum flavum. I think that's a good window between the spines. Maybe those are transverse processes, but seeing it on a BMI of 25, 30, it's real easy to see the pretty pictures.
Yeah.
And then sort of the same thing that we talked about earlier, like, you know, medications. Let's do a chlorpromazine postpartum tuple. Why not? You see that you can use it.
Yeah. No, I love that. I often tell our CA2s, you know, if you're at a good program and you're, you know, halfway through residency, now you're halfway through CA2 year, you know, you're probably pretty good at anesthesia. You probably could coast to the end, but you will never be the best you can be if you do that. The way to be the best you can be is to push yourself, even though you don't have to. And that's things like when you're on OB, ask your attending, could we try some lateral epidurals, right? Can we use the ultrasound? When you're in the OR, instead of just doing the intubation, which will come easy to you, you know, give yourself that grade 3 view on purpose, you know, get the grade 1 view, then pull back until you have a grade 3 view and then use the bougie, right? So figure out ways to challenge yourself, and that's how you'll really grow.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I try to have the residents do at least once during their month rotation is, if everything's stable out on the floor and we're, you know, in the OR, I say that I'll sit here at the head. You go stand at the feet and just get that surgical perspective, like watching the OBs push on the upper abdomen as they're delivering that head through that tiny little incision. It's a good perspective to have when you're up on the other side. Because for many of them, they probably haven't seen a cesarean delivery since third year of med school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
When residents are doing a lateral epidural, are there kind of, you know, things to keep in mind that are different than sitting? I mean, I would imagine that the spine sags, right? It's not just going straight anymore. Like, what tips do you give them to try to maximize success in the lateral position?
Good question. So commonly in the pregnant patient, the hips are a little wider. So if you just lay her on a flat OR table or a flat bed, the spine will sort of be in a little bit of Trendelenburg position. So if we're in the operating room, the easiest thing to do is move the bed into reverse T till the spine is parallel to the floor. And then in the labor rooms, we just prop the head and or shoulders up. So ideally start with the spine parallel to the floor. And then I find the space and the way I do it actually is once I find the space, put the lidocaine in, I have my TUI positioned as if the patient is sitting up. So the wings are going left and right, not up and down. It's horizontal. And in my opinion, I feel as though that's what we do every day, like that hand-eye coordination of the wings being in that position rather than turning your body to match the patient's body. So your hands are in that position, but every time you hit bone, you have to remember the spine is 90 degrees to what I'm used to. So if you hit bone and you think you're on spine, you'll come back and move slightly probably towards the patient's head.
Right, which is left instead of up. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And the other thing is I try to teach residents, certainly early in their rotation, and then if they're doing something new, like a lateral spinal or a lateral epidural, that every time you hit bone, that's a win. Like, take that information and build that 3D model of the spine in your brain. Like, okay, I hit bone. I think I'm on spine. Come back a little bit deeper, a little bit deeper. Oh, now I'm shallow. Okay, so you probably were hitting the spine below, and now all of a sudden this is so much more sharp spinal, you're not probably hitting the spine above. So come back and redirect somehow. Make your wheel bigger, a little bit higher on the in the space.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not a it shouldn't frustrate you. I mean, we all get frustrated, but that's a win. Like, okay, now where am I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Anything new coming down the pike in OB anesthesia for folks who are, you know, residents who are thinking about going into it? Is there anything that you think, oh, this is like, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years, this is what to keep your eye on. This is going to be really exciting. Maybe the answer is no, but I'm curious what you think.
If there's any fellows or CA3s listening, we're hiring here at UNC.
Shameless plug.
I do think, and this is true, I think in every aspect of anesthesia, patients are getting sicker. So, I think certainly, you know, somebody with a cardiac fellowship who maybe ends up at an academic center and they really loved OB, but they couldn't decide between OB and cardiac. If you do cardiac and you still want to do OB, you can end up somewhere. You could end up in private practice in a big group. You could end up at academic medical center and you can be the OB cardiac consult, right? You're the person that is on our team. You go to the multidisciplinary meetings about the patient with congenital cardiac disease or the patient with HOCM, and we're going to deliver her in the main OR. And you will be right there holding our hand, doing the TEE or whatever it is. So I think cardiac and ICU, critical care, those are definitely very close colleagues of ours in the near future. And, you know, if somebody wants to do 2 years, then I would say cardiac OB, critical care OB, you can't go wrong.
Yeah. And we're starting to see that. You know, I think it's so cool. I remember I loved OB as a resident, and I knew I wanted to do critical care. I briefly toyed with the idea of doing both, but A, I was already older and my wife was not so interested in me doing 2 fellowships. And also, I didn't know anybody. It wasn't a thing I could like talk to. And nobody was doing that. I didn't know anybody who had done it. But now there are people doing critical care and OB. As you said, there are people doing cardiac and OB. So I think that's really neat. And those people are going to have, I think, really cool careers.
Yeah. And they'll be sought after for sure. Right.
Well, Bridget, this has been fabulous. So interesting. So much great stuff for people to think about and learn. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Anything you would recommend people check out for fun?
I love reading in my free time. I love historical fiction. I just finished one last week. It's called The Great Divide by Christina Henrique. And it tracks a couple of different characters in the digging, building of the Panama Canal. And admittedly, I knew nothing about the colonization of Panama by the United States and really the 10, 12 years of digging this. I think it's 10 miles across Central America, but you know, people from Barbados and people from Cuba and, you know, local people. And so the United States, yes, we funded it, but we also, you know, essentially enslaved people to dig it. But really great stories within the big story of different people that are there at the time. Yeah.
Very cool.
Divide.
I have not heard of it, but I'll have to check it out. I'm going to recommend a podcast that a friend of mine recently got me into and I really love, called Plain English by Derek Thompson. And it is just a really, he covers all kinds of things, from a recent one he did on kind of, is AI going to take our jobs? He's not a doctor or anything, but he did do one recently and he interviews people. So, you know, brings on, but he talked to somebody about GLP-1 agonists, like, should they be in the drinking water? Right. Like, what do we need to do? Economics, I mean, kind of everything, but from a really just thoughtful and And I think very kind of unbiased standpoint, just like thinking about the issues in a very open way, asking people for thoughts and putting interesting thoughts out there. So highly recommend Plain English by Derek Thompson. All right, Bridget, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jed. Have a great day.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast. And you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC. Or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Stuck in a dinner rut? Let CookUnity handle dinner with chef-crafted meals delivered right to your door. CookUnity makes it easy with new menu drops, weekly recommendations, and a growing community of award-winning chefs, plus over 400 flavorful meals for every palate. Shake up your meal routine. Go to cookunity.com/mealtime50 or enter code mealtime50 before checkout for 50% off your first week. That's cookunity.com/mealtime50.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.